Hi, and welcome to Collider Science. Here you find answers about cognition that you may or may not have asked yourself. This episode is hosted by Imogen Hüsing and Sönke Löw. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this week's episode.
Is a deadline approaching and you have only barely started working on your task? Do you get stage fright when needing to hold presentations? Or do you already get queasy about needing to spend the holidays with your grandparents that don't get along? And why can your friend with stage fright hold a great presentation while you just end up stumbling over your words? Everyone experiences stress from time to time. How stress and the hormones connected to it impact our cognition is the question we want to explore in this episode with our guest, Dr. Katja Langer. She is a postdoctoral researcher at the Ruhr University in Bochum. She studied psychology and cognitive neuroscience at the same university and has written her doctoral thesis on effects of acute stress and cortisol on cognitive emotion regulation. And she's also working currently as a psychological psychotherapist. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me here.
And as always, we like to play our short little welcome game. And for that, I will start 5 sentences and we want you to spontaneously continue the sentences. And the first sentence is, as a kid, I always wanted to be.
Free?
The second sentence is, if I was an emoji, I would be.
A happy emoji.
That's nice. The third sentence is, my favorite thing to do on a day off is?
To go to the sauna and doing sports.
Very nice.
The fourth sentence is, right now I'm most fascinated by?
I'm most fascinated by my new research project on emotion regulation flexibility. So how flexible we are in coping with emotions.
That does sound interesting. And the last sentence is, I know it's time to call it a day when?
At the point when I get frustrated, I'm stuck to a problem. And I think, okay, if I'm doing it or I'm continuing in doing this task at this moment, then it will get even worse. So I'm stuck.
Nice. Yeah, I think that is actually quite a new answer. We have some repeating ones, but yeah, that's also a very good point to stop when you get too frustrated.
Yeah, it's sometimes, I think, particularly in research, sometimes you know, okay, now it's not getting better since I'm maybe overwhelmed with data or with a question or with a problem. And yeah, then yeah. Sometimes you need some rest. And then you go again to this problem and continue with this problem. And it's, yeah, then it feels more easy, I guess. So, yeah.
Yeah, and we also know sleeping a night on it can also help.
Yeah.
Find new solutions or something like that. Yeah, just having that marinate somewhere in the brain.
Yeah, of course. And related to the topic of today, also some other regulatory strategies, doing sports, for instance, or talking to a friend. And then afterwards, you feel the problem is much more easy than you expected it to be.
Yeah.
Before we go deeper into that, we still want to learn a little bit more about you. And Imogen already mentioned that you studied psychology at the Ruhr University Bochum. How did you, like, when did you realize that that is what you wanted to do? And then how was your scientific career to the point you are at right now?
Yeah, I started, so actually it was a kind of spontaneous guess, I would say. So at the end of school, I had a look which direction I want to go, and then I saw neuroscience. It's so fascinating. I read a lot to neuroscience, and then I thought, cognitive neuroscience, this is something which I need to know, even though I didn't know anything about that, but it feels like it's so fascinating. And then I started studying psychology. And also at the very beginning, I directed to the cognitive neuroscience spectrum. But then I had an internship a rather therapeutic internship, which was a duty internship during my studies. And then I started to think that the therapeutic work is also kind of interesting. And it was, yeah, confused which direction I should go, cognitive neuroscience or therapeutic, being psychological psychotherapist. And yeah, I can't answer this question. And that's the reason why I thought, okay, I need to do both.
Yeah, it's so cool that you can do that in parallel. I always feel like if I want to do science, I have to 100% commit to it. But maybe that's not the case. Maybe there is the way to do it in parallel.
Yeah, often people say it's not possible, but it is. So I think it's even beneficial to do both, since during psychotherapy, you can use some insights from neuroscience to explain what happens here. And this is even beneficial for the work in research, but also beneficial for the work as a psychotherapist. So I like it very much, and I can recommend it to everyone who wants to go this way.
Very cool. Yeah, the examples from the beginning already hinted at the topic that we want to cover today, which is stress hormones and how they impact our cognition. And let's just stick with the examples from the beginning. They are all quite different situations, but colloquially, we would call them all stressful. Is that even like scientifically correct? And would you differentiate between these types of stress, or are they all the same type of stress?
Yeah, I think there are indeed there are different types of stress. So, but in general, I would say stressful experiences are highly individual experiences. It's not a uniform phenomenon, and you cannot say one situation is stressful for everyone. Every individual experiences stress differently. Different situations are stressful. In terms of the question whether there are different kinds of stress, there are two main distinctions which we should make. There's on the one hand the distinction between rather positive stress and negative stress. When we are talking about stress, then you often mean some kind of negative experience, that you feel exhausted or maybe rather with a negative mood is associated. But there's also a positive stress sometimes, so feeling more challenged or excited to go deeper into a topic, or when having maybe a new job, or you get the option for a new job and then you are excited. So it's related rather to a little nervous reaction inside, but not negative. This is, I think, something very critical, since positive stress is really relevant to motivate yourself. And you need then stress to reach that goal, for instance. If you are completely relaxed, then sometimes not very good. Especially when you are maybe learning for an exam, then sometimes you need some stress, some kind of pushing stress to learn, and then you reach your goal, for instance. But sometimes there are also stressful experiences which are not experienced as positive, as you already told us. So, this is called a rather negative stress, which is rather demotivating. And it critically depends on how you appraise a situation. So if you appraise a situation as threatening, maybe to your social self, that you think, okay, if I'm doing this or that, then it's extremely then I'm extremely ashamed, or another person then gets a completely different image from myself, and then you're feeling stressed. And the other point is that you experience a situation that your own coping abilities to deal with this situation are insufficient, so that you have the experience that you cannot cope with this situation. That is the other appraisal process, as we call this. Some people highly differ in these appraisal processes, and then that's the reason why different situations can also have a different impact on yourself.
I mean, to me, that makes sense, but it also like raises a question for me, because like if every individual differentiates between how they handle stress and there are mm-hmm. different types of stress, doesn't that make researching stress extremely difficult, because like the variables are so diverse, and then do different types of stress need different methodologies for research?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, that's the case, that it's extremely, so on the one hand you can say it's difficult, and on the other hand you can say it's extremely interesting, since there are so many variables which you can research. But yeah, and of course we need some, so we need to control, at the best case you control for everything which is related to the stressor situation for every individual. That's not possible. But in research, we try to approach that, to assess these variables. And every researcher, I think, focuses on another aspect. So in my research, I focus rather on the negative aspect of stress, but there are also some researchers focusing on positive aspects, so on these positive stressful experiences. Yeah, and when you then are focused on rather negative stress, it's a bit more easy then to ask the question, which inter-individual differences explain these different negative feelings, for instance.
How can you research negative stress and get it through the ethics committee? Like, do it in a way that
good question
is within reason.
Good question. So especially in experimental research, so I think research in daily life with normal everyday life stresses is not so ethically critical, since all people encounter different stresses in daily life. But in experimental research, we need to manipulate stress. So that's the reason why the participants need to be stressed in the laboratory. But the stressors which we are using are not extremely intensive stressors which cannot be coped with. So one important point is that we exclude any participant who suffers from mental health problems. So in my research, so that's the reason why we can expose them to stressors without any risk, I would say. And the stressors which we are using they are negative and maybe also shaming a little bit, but not not so intensive that the people say it's not, it's quite similar to a daily life stressor, I would say. So in my research, I often use it's called the Trier social stress test. It's a very common stress test in which the participants need to simulate a mock job interview in front of a panel, and the panel is not your best friend, I would say. The panel is very reserved and neutral looking, and asking no questions at all, but just staring at you, and you are videotaped. It's a kind of weird situation, but it's not, it's not so intensive. It's weird, but it's okay. And that's so, the ethical committees are okay with this procedure. But this is only an example for doing research in acute stress. It's also another research line which is related to chronic stress. So we also need to distinguish acute stress and from chronic stress. When we are talking about stress, then you often mean maybe in daily life rather chronic stress. So being stressed for a longer period of time and maybe with lack of recovery, and you all the time maybe feel stressed out. And in laboratory research, we often use acute stress or short-term stressors to then to examine in how far stress in how far or which mechanisms influence acute stress reactions, and also the other way around, how acute stress responses then influence some kind of cognitive processes, for instance. And this is kind of very interesting for us, since we can then, when we have new insights into these effects, we can discuss in how far differences between people occur in these effects and may lead to chronic stress states. So in my research, I focus on the negative aspects of acute stress, and some other researchers, as I already said, then use some other methodological approach. So chronic stress, I think to manipulate chronic stress, this would, yeah, indeed would be ethically problematic. So you can't induce chronic stress without risk, I would say. Yeah.
Okay, maybe we can go a bit more into the neuroscience aspect now. Which brain areas are involved in perceiving and managing stress? And is there a difference for acute and chronic stress?
Yes, maybe at first we start with acute stress, and there are two different pathways. So on the one hand, we have an unconscious pathway. So that's the reason why you can react even though you did not realize that there was a stressor anyways. Or for instance, when you you go into a room and you don't expect a friend to be there or a person to be there, and then you are kind of shocked when you see the person, even though you know it's not threatening and it's not stressful, but you are shocked, and this is the unconscious pathway. This is so this is activated by the thalamus and the amygdala. This is the central station of emotional activation in the brain, and directly then activates the hypothalamus. This is the first node of the two stress axes. On the one hand, we have the sympathetic nervous system going through to the adrenal glands, then leading to the release of adrenaline and noradrenaline, for instance. And on the other hand, we have the HPA axis, from the hypothalamus to the pituitary, and then also from the adrenal cortex, releasing glucocorticoids like cortisol. This is released in the via the unconscious pathway, but also via the conscious pathway. This is the second one. The differences between the unconscious and the conscious pathway is that in the conscious pathway, the stimulus, so the situation, for instance, is appraised via the prefrontal cortex. This is the central control station of our brain, which interprets the situation in a way which is rather stressful, for instance. And then the hypothalamus is activated by the threatening interpretation of the prefrontal cortex, then leading to the activation of the two stress axes, which finally then leads to the bodily responses which are related to stress. So kind of getting sweaty hands, the heartbeat rises, the blood pressure is higher. So all these stress reactions are then activated by, at the end by our brain, I would say.
Okay, just to recap and for me to see whether I understood it correctly. So there are basically two ways how the stress system can be triggered, the unconscious pathway and the conscious pathway. But basically the results and the hormones that are released are the same for the conscious and unconscious pathway.
Yeah, so the both pathways in the brain activates these two main stress axes, the sympathetic nervous system and the HPA axis. The difference is the prefrontal cortex activated or not, whether you realize that it's stressful or not. Yeah.
Okay. And how does it look like for chronic stress? What is the brain activation for that?
Question, yeah. Yeah, there are some theories behind it. So to answer this question, we need to talk about how it comes to chronic stress. So chronic stress is nothing which is, at some point there. This is something, so it is a result from something else. So there are some theories postulating that chronic stress is the result of a lack of adaptation to acute stressors in daily life, or and or lack of recovery of intensive stresses in daily life. For instance, there is an exam, it's an acute stressor, and you, yeah, after the exam, you do not recover from this. You are all the time, you're still stressed since you are thinking about this exam. You are thinking about something like, worst performance in this exam or something like that. And then you suffer from chronic stress. So there might be some continuing appraisal processes afterwards, some kind of maybe rumination. It's, it could be one mechanism one mechanism which can reduce or prevent recovery of acute stress and then leading to chronic stress. The mechanisms then on brain level could be that different prefrontal cortex interpretations I would say can lead then to chronic stress states. And in research, we found that then that prefrontal neurons in prefrontal cortex are damaged during chronic stress. So that also the results or the effects of chronic stress on the brain or brain activity can also be a risk factor for continuing with chronic stress, continuing feeling chronically stressed, since you are then do not have anymore the resources, the prefrontal resources, to come out of this, to maybe positively reappraise a certain stressor, to think about something in which you are good, for instance, if you are stressed. Back to the example on the exams, and that's I would say a vicious cycle between maybe deficits in prefrontal control, in cognitive control capacities, then maybe you are vulnerable to chronic stress, and then you are even getting more vulnerable for more stress since damaging effects which are mostly led by the glucocorticoids like cortisol, which are enhanced during chronic stress, then leading to damaging effects on neurons in the prefrontal cortex, but also in the hippocampus in the brain, which then leads to the maintenance of chronic stress states.
We invited you, or we structured our podcast in a way that we have blogs on certain topics, and we invited you in the context of a blog on hormones. You already mentioned some, but can you maybe now again explicitly state like which hormones play an important role and what role do they play in stress?
Yeah, of course. Hormones are, I think, our well-being or our mental state in general is critically depends on our hormonal status, not only on stress hormones, but also from stress hormones. On the one hand, as I already mentioned, we have these glucocorticoids. So cortisol is the most famous hormone, I would say, stress hormone, which is released from the adrenal cortex and can pass the blood-brain barrier, and then can also activate receptors which are located in the brain, so at the neurons, and is therefore able to change activities, brain activity. And on the other hand, we also have the catecholamines, so for instance, adrenaline, noradrenaline, dopamine. These are also hormones when released from the adrenal medulla, and then have different effects in the periphery on heart, on lungs, on sweating, for instance, but cannot pass the blood-brain barrier. This is interesting, but we indeed find effects of hormones like adrenaline or noradrenaline in the brain. And that's the reason why researchers could show that there's a second source of adrenaline and noradrenaline in the brain, directly in the brain. So the amount of cortisol which comes into our brain is the product of our of our body in the periphery, but the adrenaline and noradrenaline, which is in our brain, stays in our brain. So there's a small structure of the locus coeruleus, which is in the brain and releases catecholamines like adrenaline and noradrenaline, then also activating or deactivating specific structures like amygdala, like prefrontal cortex, leading then to different changes in our mental states when we are stressed. Yeah, these are the main hormones when we are stressed, but there are also other hormones like sex steroids, for instance, testosterone, progesterone and estradiol, so the typical sex hormones, and they interact with other hormones. So there's a lot of research showing that these sex hormones interact with stress hormones in the way that they then create this special or the specific effects which we find in fMRI studies, for instance, when we have a look at how the brain changes its activity when we are stressed. So it's an interaction between sex and stress hormones in the brain. It's really interesting. And there are also a lot of other hormones, but yeah, it's kind of too intense, I would say.
Let's bring it back to the cognitive functions. So how do these hormones impact our cognitive functions, our cognitive abilities? And is there a difference for acute and chronic stress? Or what is the difference for acute and chronic stress?
Under acute stress, so let's start again with acute stress. So it's usually that we feel, this is something which we maybe also feel personally. So when you are stressed, you feel very focused on specific aspects. This is the result of hormonal effects in the brain shifting the attention towards stressful aspects of a situation. So you might you do not remember maybe the room where you have written the exam, but the specific view of the of the professor, which looked at you, feeling you so maybe ashamed. This is something which you remember. So you, so not only your attention, but also the memory is improved for stress salient, stress specific aspects. And usually in this early, during acute stress, prefrontal cortex activity, so cognitive control, is reduced. So this is also a mechanism often shown also in fMRI studies, that the activity of areas like the prefrontal cortex is reduced when you are completely stressed. And as a result, you are not so able to do very exhausting or difficult tasks, for instance. So go back to the exam example. If you have learned a lot and all these memories are very automatically in your brain, then it's not so strongly stored in the prefrontal cortex, and you can write it down and you can retrieve this information. But if you have learned not so much and you need a lot of prefrontal cortex activity to read the questions, and maybe you are so overwhelmed, then when it comes to stress, then you are not good at it anymore. So this is a typical finding, that you are not so able when you are stressed in such tasks like working memory tasks, like cognitive control tasks in this direction. But it depends on when you measure the cognitive function, since in some studies there are also some kind of beneficial effects, so that stress can even help your brain to work correctly. So this is especially the case in my research. So I found that in very early time slots after stress, when you encounter a stressor, when adrenaline and noradrenaline is high, that then your cognitive control capacities are potentially reduced, and also your cognitive regulation capacities are reduced, and you are less in regulating cognitively your emotion. But later, when cortisol actions come into play, so it's rather about 30 minutes after stress, then it gets reversed, so that there are even beneficial effects of such hormones on your cognitive capacity to regulate certain emotions. And that's the reason why in research there's the idea, not only on emotion regulation, but in cognitive functioning in general, that there's this, so opposing actions in a very initial situation when you are stressed, that your cognitive control functions are reduced. But then after some time, they get restored, and there are some beneficial effects of some slower working hormones like cortisol, or delayed actions of cortisol, that you are then you are better in some cognitive functions. And that's the reason why I would say healthy people, or normally recovering people from stress, why they recover actually. And the question is then, maybe those people who do not recover then suffer from chronic stress and are more vulnerable for some psychopathological symptoms. The main question is, why is this the case? So that we need these hormonal actions from adrenaline, noradrenaline, and also from cortisol later, so these beneficial effects on cognitive functioning, to recover, and that at certain people these hormones are not well secreted, and so these actions in the brain are not well concerted, and that these individual differences then lead to chronic stress. And under chronic stress, then you often see that something like, as I told you a few minutes ago, so that there is these damaging effects on the prefrontal cortex in general. So that neurons are, it's not toxic, so the neurons are not dead and then it's gone. So there is hope for all the people who are chronically stressed. So you can recover from it. But in the moment when you feel chronically stressed, then usually your prefrontal cortex is not so well working, and you usually find also reduced performances in cognitive tasks. You also find reduced performances in emotion regulation, so the ability to regulate certain emotions is reduced. And this is most probably related to these damaging effects on the prefrontal cortex. But there are also some other structures, not only the prefrontal cortex, like the hippocampus and the thalamus, also critical structures. So the brain is very complex. There are a lot of it's a whole net of neurons connected to each other, all these structures. So we cannot say it's the prefrontal cortex, but in research often it's the case that we find that these damaging effects there. And another structure at the last point is the amygdala. So when you are chronically stressed, the amygdala is overactivated. So you have a very high activation of this emotional, this central emotional structure in your brain. And the connection between prefrontal cortex and amygdala is also damaged, so that you... that the prefrontal cortex is per se not that well working, and also not so well connected to the amygdala. And that might be the reason why the amygdala is so strongly activated when you are chronically stressed and you cannot calm down. But potentially, if you then work hard in your emotion regulation skills, you can turn it around, coming back to acute stress.
Okay, before we dive into emotion regulation, maybe we can just recap a bit what role hormones play in this mechanism. Mm-hmm. So did I understand it correctly that in the beginning of acute stress, noradrenaline and adrenaline are kind of the main actors, and then later on you get more of the effects of cortisol? Like what effects do they have?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a critical point. So adrenaline and noradrenaline, so both systems, the sympathetic nervous system and the HPA axis, are activated in parallel, but the sympathetic nervous system is a rather fast-acting system. So adrenaline, noradrenaline are directly released by the adrenal medulla in the periphery and therefore acting very fast directly. But the HPA axis is the rather slow pathway. And this leads approximately 20 to 40 minutes after stress onset to an increase in cortisol or the secretion of cortisol from the adrenal cortex. And that's the reason why these actions of cortisol, which we also find in the brain, are visible a little later than those effects of noradrenaline and adrenaline. Yeah.
I would now transition into like emotion regulation. And while you were talking, I started thinking, because I always considered stress to be like an emotion in and of itself. And because I would say like, I feel stressed. But now I started thinking like, if maybe stress has a special place within like the realm of emotions, because like, I would also say like, I feel attentive or something, but that's not, being attentive is not an emotion to me. And I would be interested, what's your perspective on what being stressed is and how the relation to other emotions is?
Yeah, good, very good question. So actually, stress is not an emotion, but we all know what we mean when we say it's we are feeling stressed. So the most often related emotion is anxiety and shame at the end. So we often feel stressed when we feel shamed, or we expect to feel ashamed. So for instance, yeah, there's a job interview and you expect to feel ashamed during this interview, you get stressed in attending the situation even. But also anxiety, yes. So we need it's interesting to think about the evolutionary perspective of stress. So the reason why we feel stressed and all these functions or effects in the brain is that the body wants us to survive. And in certain situations, in which we are currently stressed, these stress systems are also activated, but in former times, so in really far away former times, these typical stressors like a job interview weren't there. The stressor like being confronted with an animal like a snake or like a bear, this was a stressor in former times, and our organism is still in this mode. So when we are in the present, nowadays, when we feel stressed, then our body thinks we are confronted with a very dangerous snake or a dangerous bear, and then gets activated. And then the emotion, anxiety, to fear maybe such a situation is very adaptive. So you need to feel anxious when you are confronted with a bear or a snake. And the emotion is therefore adaptive, since it provides you important information. The important information that you now have to flee. You should flee to survive. And and nowadays, as I already said, this is not the typical stressor, but the same process comes into play. So maybe you are stressed, for instance, stressed since you there's a job interview coming in your life, and you feel maybe also anxious since you experience the situations as threatening for you. So it's a very often emotion, so anxiety and shame, who are related to stress. Yeah.
And when you say that during acute stress, emotion regulation is kind of diminished, and then we only later can regulate our emotions, maybe even better. What do you mean, or what do you understand under emotion regulation?
In general, I would say emotional regulation is basically how we manage and how we manage our feelings. So how we influence which emotions we have, when we have them, and also how we express them and how intense they are. So it's not about shutting an emotion down or pretending they don't exist or something like that. It's about understanding an emotion and then to appraise whether it's adaptive to regulate its intensity or its direction in a certain way with respect to a specific goal, for instance. Let's have an example when you are sitting maybe you're listening to a presentation and you are thinking about a nice situation in the past which makes you very strongly laughing. That's a very funny situation, but you don't want to laugh in this moment. You don't want to laugh since it would be not very respectful to the presenter of this talk where you're listening to. That's the reason why you need to reduce a positive emotion, since it's very related or goal directed it's very important for your goal to listen to the talk. This is an example. So this example shows that it's not always down regulation of negative emotions. Emotion regulation means both. So up and down regulation of positive and negative emotions. And depending on your specific goal in this situation, and also critically depending on your resources, which resources you have, in which direction you can go with your emotion. That's basically what I understand when I think about emotion regulation. It's sometimes also necessary to upregulate negative emotions, for instance. So if you have a loss of a close relative, for instance, you need to be sad and you need to maybe even upregulate your sadness. So it's important to process that you have experienced this loss. I would say a person is very competent in emotion regulation. So emotion regulation competencies are high when you can flexibly adapt your emotions with respect to the specific goal in a situation.
What are some strategies for emotion regulation? Mm-hmm. Like, for example, or specifically now for stressful situations, since you mentioned that emotion regulation is very important to avoid chronic stress?
Yeah, so there are different strategies. Also, on the behavioral level, there are different strategies. For instance, if there's a situation if you can change a situation, then it's very adaptive to change the situation by your behavior, maybe to talk to a friend talking to a friend when you have an argument with him or her, for instance, or other kinds of changing the situation itself, or you can also avoid a situation. So if you know you are very anxious in writing exams, then you avoid writing the exam. It's also kind of regulating, so you're not feeling anxious anymore. And there are also strategies rather mental or cognitive strategies. They can all either relate to the attention process, so you can shift your attention away from a stimulus, so you can shift the attention to another topic, so not thinking about the exam, but thinking about the next holiday, for instance. Or you can also do another task, so whenever there comes thoughts in mind related to the exam, you can then maybe do a very nice task, playing piano or doing some other things. So it's also kind of regulating. And the third note of emotion regulation, of third block of emotion regulation strategies, is related to the cognitive change. So you can appraise a certain situation in a different way or try to reappraise it in a positive way, for instance, or if you need to upregulate negative emotions, you can also try to intensify the negative appraisals. It's also possible. So to change how you interpret a certain situation, this is the these are strategies on the cognitive change level. It's especially relevant also in therapeutic and the therapeutic work. So that especially the behavioral therapy is related to change the cognitive appraisals of certain situations. Yeah, and that's all these strategies are not per se adaptive or maladaptive. It's okay to avoid a certain situation. It's okay to avoid or to avoid a certain emotion. But it can then be maladaptive when you rely on a certain strategy too much. So if you all the time avoid going to exams, then you can maybe suffer from it since you cannot continue with your studies. And it's maybe not a good idea all the time to distract your attention towards a very stressful topic if you cannot, you need to pre-process maybe the emotion to this situation. Yeah, just like an example. So I think you are very good in, so it's always a matter of flexibility between the strategies. Yeah. That you can take the one or the other one, you cannot say one strategy is better than the other in general.
What happens on a neural level when we, for example, up or down regulate a certain emotion?
Yeah. So I cannot say what happens when you are doing behavioral strategies since I'm not researcher for this kind of behavioral strategies. So my focus is the research on cognitive emotion regulation. This relates to the attention and cognitive change level. And there we often see the prefrontal cortex, which is related to the attentional control process, but also related to the cognitive change process, that you need your prefrontal cortex. And not only the prefrontal cortex, but together with some other surrounding structures, which are connected to parietal structures, for instance, which are connected to the amygdala and to the insula, also a second structure of rather emotion-related structures. And these parietal and prefrontal structures then inhibit have an inhibiting influence on amygdala, insula, so all these emotion-related structures. But it can also be the other way around. So you can also upregulate emotions the other way around, so that the amygdala, insula, for instance, are activated more intense and then can also inhibit the prefront. So it's not in one direction, but it's working within this network, and it's rather the connection between the control structures and the emotion-related structures, I would say.
Can you give an example on how you research that? Like, can you talk about maybe an experiment that you do or instructions that you give? Or is it still ongoing and you can't talk about it in case anybody listens to the podcast before they go into the experiment?
I can do it. You mean rather related to the emotion regulation aspects, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. So it's very hard to... I think the most challenge in emotion regulation research is... how can we measure emotion? So it's so highly individual how you experience an emotion, but we need some outcome measures, and we need different outcome measures, which then draw a whole picture of what's happening in the brain, in the body, and in the experience of the participants, of the people. We usually use some kind of computer-based task. So in my research, I often use pictures, negative pictures, to induce a negative emotion there are some databases, standardized databases, which provide different pictures. And these pictures are then used to induce emotions, and then people get the instructions to apply a certain strategy, for instance, when being confronted to a certain picture. But this is not only once, but there's a computer-based paradigm in which there are maybe about 60, 80 trials or 60, 80 pictures with which the participants are confronted, and then they are instructed to either just view the picture as a control condition. They simply view the picture and experience the emotions, the upcoming emotions naturally, or they are instructed to, for instance, positively reappraise the situation on the picture, or they are instructed to distract their attention towards something else, towards a neutral situation in their life, in my research, but sometimes also to positive aspects, but not related to the picture which is presented. This is one way how we can research that, but in another study, which I finished a few weeks ago, we used the TSST as the stress test as an emotion induction method. So yeah, as you said, stress is also related to emotions like anxiety, for instance. And in this study, the participants were stressed with the TSST, and then afterwards they got a questionnaire with different questions which should induce a reappraisal process. So they were rather forced to generate positive reappraisals of the situation experienced before, and to rather interpret the situation as a challenge, not as a threat, or to think about all these experiences in a rather positive way. And the another group was then expected to ruminate afterwards. Yeah, this may be also a kind of question, ethical question, but yes, the ethical committee said it's okay. In this rumination questionnaire, the people were asked to think about all negative aspects experienced in this trier social stress test, in this mock job interview, and they were asked something like which impression could the panel have now have from yourself after you performed so relatively bad in this situation. So rather directed in a more distressing way, this question. It's also another idea to come up with this. But yeah, experimental research in emotion regulation is always some kind of artificial, but we need these artificial approaches to directly know from which factors which we manipulate the effects which we then see in the data are coming. That's the reason why it's, for some people it seems to be not a little bit far away from everyday life, but I think it's that this is always the case in basic research, and we need then so these effects which we find here in the research, I would be so interesting in whether we find more or less similar effects in daily life when other researchers take our effects and try to find them in everyday life.
It's always, for me, it's always so interesting to hear how the actual experiments look like, because you are looking at so complex systems, and you ask yourself, how can you even break it down so you can basically look at it in a lab setting? And it's really, really interesting. A lot of our listeners are students, so they probably experience quite a lot of stressful situations in terms of exams and so on. Do you have any concrete tips how they could deal with stress, like before writing an exam or before doing a presentation or before going into a job interview or something like that?
Yeah, I think if I gave a general tip, then I would be a researcher. So maybe we think at the beginning of the podcast, I said, stress and also emotions are experienced very individually, and also the need to regulate is very individual. So there is no general tip, but the most, I think, very important is that you try to regulate in a way which is good for you in that moment. So sometimes people think, okay, I need to do that. I need to positively think that it will be a good exam, something like that. But if you feel that it will be a bad exam and that you are anxious, then it is not working that you say it's okay, it's positive, it's not a problem. Then you need a strategy maybe which says it's okay to feel anxiety. It's so rather acceptance. Or it's okay to say, I avoid this exam, but next time I will write this exam. So my tip would be to be friendly to yourself and to accept your emotions and to take them as a very interesting information about yourself, but to that you don't fear on emotions, that you are not that you don't think you need to stop them. And sometimes emotions, this is maybe, of course, rather general. Sometimes emotions are not the reality. And even though we know that it's not reality, we are afraid of our emotions. But there's no need to be afraid. Emotions are very critical. If there were no emotions, then there will be no well-being at all. So we need our emotions to guide our way through this very challenging life. And we should be very thankful to have them. Even though I know sometimes we're not thankful for that. And we think, I don't want to be anxious. I think it's very helpful to accept it. And then having a look, what can you do to increase your well-being? So sometimes when we are suffering from very bad emotions, like anxiety in an exam, then we need some kind of other times where we feel other emotions. Maybe doing some sports, meeting with friends, and not to say, I need to reappraise it or to think about it a different way or avoid it. Sometimes it's just like I need some relaxed time, some time to recover, and then I can be more friendly to myself.
In the beginning, you said that when you started, you were especially intrigued by cognitive neuroscience. What do you think is the role that cognition plays in the research you are doing today?
Yeah, I think a large role. So cognition, I think the main focus of my research is the cognitive level of emotion regulation. So how able we are in regulating our emotions with cognitive processes like attention, cognitive change, and how these mechanisms contribute to the stressful experiences, but also the other way around, how stressful experiences have an effect on these cognitive processes. And at the end, to answer the question, what are the differences in our cognitive processes which may explain vulnerability for chronic stress days, for depression or other stress-related disorders? And so I think cognition is the main answer then at this moment, or not the main answer, but for me, very interesting to see in how far differences in these cognitive processes, and in also in my new research project, I going deeper into cognitive flexibility, cognitive emotion regulation flexibility. And this provides maybe the answer or some kind of answer which people are more vulnerable and which are resilient to certain stress situations.
And what would be your, like, the one point that our listeners should take away from this episode?
Stress is, you feel stressed, the body feels stressed, and then the brain feels stressed, and all this together forms your mental state. Remember that. And it's very important to regulate when it's needed, but only under the condition that you have the resources to do that and you cannot pressure yourself in a direction where you are not. Very difficult question. One point. I cannot say one point. I'm a yeah. Maybe if I would to do it on one point, then it's interesting to study hormones.
Nice.
Then thank you very much for being our guest today and talking to us.
Yeah, thank you for these nice questions and the nice exchange for having me here.
This was Kaleidoscience. We hope that you enjoyed this episode and we would love to have your feedback. You can rate our podcast and give us feedback on our Instagram account. Have a great week and you'll hear from us again in 2 weeks. This episode was hosted by Imogen Hüsing and Sönke Löw. Produced by Imogen Hüsing, Clara Kühne, Sophie Kühne, Sönke Löw and Elisa Palmer. The music is from Jan-Luca Schröder and the logo is from Annika Richter.